Welcome back for episode 300. So, Joe, quite a milestone.
It really is. And I know there was a lot of people who, there was some kind of a at-will Deadpool. People were wondering if I would live long enough to see 300, but here I am. And I'm, you know.
Just don't drop dead. Don't drop dead in the middle of the show.
Right, exactly. I guess that's one of there's a side bet in that regard. But no, actually, it is quite a milestone. And I actually want to thank the audience. I can't express my gratitude, you know, to them too far, because you know, the communications really do mean a lot. It's just wonderful being able to have that kind of engagement with people who actually, you know, in my opinion, see the world clearly, because there's very few of them in my life that I actually encounter physically. So the show has really been a wonderful experience for me, and I hope we do another 300 shows before I am you know, tapped out for or whatever. But yeah, no, I want to thank the audience for.
I mean, what if indeed all the world's problems are solved and nothing else to talk about?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We're heading toward the workers' paradise. It's just around the corner.
Exactly. So we meet that nirvana, utopia, if you will.
Yeah.
Okay. Well. This week, we saw the U.S. government avoided bankruptcy, default rather, I guess the more apt term. President Joe Biden, he addressed the nation Friday evening after signing a budget deal. I think it's called the Fiscal Responsibility Act. I mean, really? I mean, it's like what was that, Anti-Inflation Act, or WIP? Or what was that?
The terms they come up with.
It's been a bipartisan deal. Basically, they cut spending by not increasing as much as they could have. But I think it raises the debt ceiling by $4 trillion. It suspends the debt ceiling for a couple of years. They won't be faced with this problem. Next few years, they can just borrow. Instead of going up $4 trillion, spending will only go up $2 trillion. So that's a spending cut in the eyes of the federal government, the way they do their budgeting. We've gotten in this idea that if the government can't continually go into debt, sell bonds, you have a financial disaster. I don't know if it's more though. I think it's either one or two is spending on. Interest payments on the debt are now or close to these what we spend on the military, I think now.
Yeah, I bet the whole thing is just so preposterous. I mean, honestly, I cannot keep a straight face when I'm like listening to these people talk about the debt ceiling crisis, because it is just so ridiculous. I mean, of course, what do they think they're going to do is say, well, I'm going to increase the debt. We're going to live off of the tax revenue. The whole system would just fall apart overnight. I mean, it would just be impossible to function. So the nation will just go on with ever increasing debt and ever greater percentages of debt relative to GDP, as long as people take the currency seriously. You know, I mean,
yeah.
There's really no end to it, because it is a religious event. You know, the dollar, the fiat currency. It's just, if people believe in it, have faith in it, and you know, they will just accept it as a means of exchange. And of course, it could just disappear overnight, because there's no real you know, nothing that is real about it. Our economy is probably one half of, I've seen just, it's like one half the size that we presented as, because there's so much financialization. Mm-hmm. That is artificial. You know, these are not goods and services. They aren't real jobs. You know, they're just artificial. It's financialization. It's make work government jobs. Everything goes into this idea of the GDP, but it's just a concept. It's not real. You know, the country is in terrible shape in terms of you know, just every sort of economic metric you can imagine. And it's just going to get worse and worse. I am kind of interested in this June 15th meeting in St. Petersburg, where, you know, 90 nations will have representatives, business representatives, and we'll see if they actually come up with some kind of work around the dollar, because this has actually been something that they've been discussing publicly now, in which they would have an anti-sanction procedure. So they would have some kind of method they would set up so that the sanctions wouldn't necessarily have political power over them. Now, there have been different, you know, people have talked about, well, it should be a gold-backed currency or a basket of commodities. You know, there are different ideas for how they could set up their own system. They have the electronic capacity already to do it. They have basically a mirror of the Swiss system. But it's just a question of how to get rid of the reliance, contractual reliance in some cases, and just the reliance based on the fact that there's so much U.S. Treasury bonds out there that are used as reserve that to, you know, the countries, a lot of them know that it's kind of cutting their nose off to spite their face to switch to a currency too quickly. I'll just point out that, you know, they talk about going to a gold-backed currency as a way of, you know, revolutionizing and freeing, you know, the world's economic system. The problem with that is just what the U.S. experienced, and which led to Bretton Woods, wherein if you have a gold-backed currency and others have very weak or corrupt currencies, then they'll just constantly change it for your gold. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you won't have any. So if they have so you can see the problem that they're going to face. If it's gold-backed, then it also has to be sequestered away from the U.S. treasuries and U.S. denominated assets, because if it was not, then obviously, particularly as the dollar started to erode, which would very quickly if you could exchange it for gold in some other form, then, you know, these people would just, all their treasuries would go to zero at one time. So they have their, I'm not sure exactly how they're going to do it. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with, but I do think they're going to try something, because if they say they're going to work around the sanctions, I think almost certainly they're going to have some kind of alternative payment method, so that if a country is sanctioned, they won't be cut off from the BRICS economic system, which is really what is the thing which can destroy the dollar, is just that they start trading, you know, the commodities and services among themselves and with their own currency, which is somehow sequestered away from the dollar world. And then, you know, they eventually get to the position where they can tell, you know, people who want energy or Chinese widgets or whatever, you got to pay us in our currency. So we will let you exchange X amount of dollars for enough currency so you can make the transaction. But we will here's where the problem is. They will set the exchange rate because they aren't going to want, you know, someone coming in there with dollars and flopping out for gold. And so it's going to be complicated, but man, these are exciting times, Tim.
Well, the meeting's in June. Are they going to have pride flags at this meeting?
I don't think so. Okay, I doubt that very much. I mean, Putin has been the most articulate anti-pride, you know, kind of spokesperson, political spokesperson in the world. He gave that speech like 2 or 3 weeks ago, where he was pointing out that we've done this whole anti-family sexual debasement thing before in Russia, when a group called the Bolsheviks had control. You know, that was absolutely what he was, you know, pointing at people. And I kind of chuckled, because thinking, yeah, and now we have the Bolsheviks.
Yep.
The dog whistle group, but anyway, it's the same problem, and so no, there won't be many pride flags there at St. Petersburg.
Yeah, they're too serious for that. Yeah, mm-hmm. As far as the this supposed negotiations to strike this budget deal, the Republicans and they're supposed they were trying to negotiate something. Of course, indicative or indicating that the really in bad faith, as they didn't get much out of the Biden or the Democrats. One thing is instead of an 80 what was it? $80 billion increase to the IRS is now it's only $60 billion. 1%. And what, you know, the current budget for the IRS is $16 billion, 16, 1, 6, $16 billion. So for some reason, now they're getting their budget. It was, do the math, but 16, almost, that's what, quadrupled. Something's up there. What do they have in store? Again, all that funding for the IRS. And that's something, some, you know, we had these, this weaponization of government hearings that Jim Jordan is presiding over in the House, exposing all this corruption with the FBI. And of course, with the Durham report, the weaponization of the U.S. intelligence community to more or less orchestrate a coup, and also to interfere with an election, a couple elections, in my opinion. And so they didn't even like negotiate a cut in the budget for the intelligence agencies or for the FBI. Simply like cut the funding for the Joint Terrorism Task Force's abusive branch of the FBI. And so nothing, none of that was, so there's no punishment there for the FBI. And it's obviously the, all the corruption that's been exposed. And you think this would have been the time to do it when theoretically, you know, the Biden administration and the federal government was up against the wall here fiscally, and they didn't do it. So, you know, you don't get anything.
That's such a good point. This would have been the time, if there was any reality to what we claim to be a two-party system, then this would have been the moment when they could have struck. And they could have exposed everything. They could have just said, okay, we, you know, here is the budget hearing, and it starts with, you know, a review of the weaponization of, you know, the 1-6 incarceration. You know, this is, these are our terms. This is what we have to go. They were in the driver's seat. If, but it wouldn't happen, and it never will happen, because they're really, as you know, there's not really two parties. They go through this as a, you know, it's just as a ritual to create the impression that we have a democracy, and that there's some kind of control over the spending, or desire to control the spending, and there's not. I mean, it's just it's that simple. It's obvious to everyone, and it's very bad theater. It is just artificial. It's a theater, but at this point, it's you know, like watching a rerun of a sitcom that you've already seen. It just, jokes aren't funny anymore. There's no reason to sit through it. It's just stupid, and we all know the conclusion.
Just in time for Pride Month, Ted Cruz, the conservative Republican senator from Texas, responded to a New York Times article on Twitter, which described Uganda's new legislation as among the most restrictive of its kind in the world. The bill, signed into law by President Yoweri Museveni, does not criminalize those who identify as LGBT. Plus, but still prescribes death penalty for aggravated homosexuality. Aggravated homosexuality is defined as cases for sexual relations involving people infected with HIV, as well as minors and other categories of vulnerable people. Senator Cruz called this Uganda law is horrific and wrong. I guess he was posturing against the law. Now, I don't know if the people of Texas or the people of the United States have too much concern for whether or not people in Africa or in Uganda in particular can sodomize each other legally, men. I don't think it's I don't think it's up there on their priorities, but nevertheless, the senator feels necessary to posture on the issue about this law. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like,
it made no sense to me because if you actually read the law, what it wasn't, you know, anti-homosexual. It's if you engage in homosexual activity and you have HIV, then this is criminal, and it's and they have a lot of different crimes in this nation that they have the death penalty for, and it was just, this is a very serious crime if you engage in sex like this. And then as far as pedophilia, that's a death penalty thing as well. I mean, it's like, what is, could Ted at least, you know, kind of go a little further here and explain to us what he had, what was wrong with these laws? You know, I mean, and I mean, obviously he's a lifetime actor. He's just a theatrical.
But who is he trying to impress with this?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. but again, it's the global home. America's number one export, other than, you know, armaments, is sexual degeneracy. You know, that's like, was it Senator from Raskin from Maryland said that reason why we have to win Ukraine because Russia is anti-LGBTQ plus, anti-homosexual, anti-feminist. So Israeli, is that what we were told? Why we had to fight or support and prolong the war in the Ukraine? Yeah. But never, I mean, it's funny because Uganda, I think this law was passed in reaction to the Pope's visit there. Pope Francis went there and told him to decriminalize it. Now we have a Catholic Pope advising countries to decriminalize homosexuality. Of course, that's sort of an abuse of papal power. And it's also a squandering of moral authority going to this country saying to do this. Now, I think he's doing this at the behest of James Martin, the head of the American Jesuits, who is an agent of the Jews. So the Pope goes there, says this. Why? I don't know. They respond with a protest. And now culturally, there's a lot of opposition to homosexuality in sub-Saharan Africa in general, but also in Uganda, because they have the Shrine of the Martyrs there. And much of Ugandan identity is based on these martyrs who died, who were martyred for refusing to engage in sexual activity for a corrupt king there in the 19th century. So this is a very factors greatly into Ugandan culture.
That's right. And it's so, cultural imperialism, because the Ugandans' position is really nuanced. You know what I mean? It's not like there's hatred. I mean, they have this tradition. It's their moral and religious background. And in the law, they have all of these, you know, basically criteria. And the Pope just comes in and says, well, this is wrong. This is morally wrong.
Why is it wrong? Yeah. Why is it morally wrong?
It's like, the thing is, look, this is like, it gets to the diminishing return moment that I talk about so often. Mm-hmm. The reason that he doesn't engage in the obvious discussion, right, about what is wrong with this law and talk about the specifics is because he can't. Because if he did, then every single person who heard what the law was and what the Pope was opposing would realize that the laws were very reasonable and that, in fact, they actually do protect children and vulnerable people. And so then, of course, this would perhaps bleed over into discussions about our own laws and about how they might be structured in a more protective way. And then suddenly the whole thing that the Pope, the global homo meme would disappear. So, the public should just demand that there is, an explanation as to why the law is wrong. What exactly is wrong with this law? Get them out in the open. It's sort of like, getting the pharmaceutical virologist to explain why, the vaccine is safe. They won't do it because they can't. So that is all the more reason why we have to insist that they do.
Well, sorry, is the law morally wrong? Well, if we want to talk about morals, let's talk about homosexuality. I mean, if we're on the subject of morals, decriminalization. I don't know. Maybe we should take a cue from Uganda and look what's happened in the West since it's been decriminalized in the 1960s and 70s. The moment you decriminalize it, the moment it's no longer explicitly illegal, it becomes promoted. Then it becomes mandatory to celebrate it effectively. Corporations. This is done through the corporations. You have to celebrate Pride Month with your company or in the schools. My son just took the SATs and he had to go to a local high school. And he told me he was walking through the hallways of the schools and it was festooned with pro-homosexual propaganda. This is a high school. Yeah. I saw a video of a class where an instructor, this was a high school class, the instructor there was instructing the students on why sodomy is pleasurable. And how the nerves in the prostate can get stimulated. This is in a classroom.
Yeah, it's a house.
High school kids. So yeah, this is what tolerance gets you. Tolerance begets acceptance. which begets promotion. And pretty soon they're knocking on your door demanding to sodomize your kids, which is what we're getting to now. It's what you get with the grooming and everything. So I think we should reconsider and criminalize it again, and to the point where it can hear this, because no longer, the moment it's decriminalized, it becomes promoted by all the institutions. That's what's going on today. Good example, you can't have a St. Patrick's Day parade or a 4th of July parade without a heavy contingent of homosexuals showing up. That destroys the parade, and pretty soon decent people stop showing up. No, only people left are homosexuals. It's like you can't have, you know, the Lions Club do their float, and the local high school, the fire department, all of a sudden a couple men in jock straps walking, you know, with dog collars on. That's literally what you're getting with these parades now. And so that's where we are. And so we're in no position to wag our finger at Uganda or any other country that still has the decency to restrict or criminalize this behavior.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a really good point, is that we need to, if this was a sane nation, we really need to revisit the decriminalization of homosexuality. Now, I know people will be aghast, you know, at this concept, you know, and they'll recognize that, you know, there are people who are legitimately to be a fraction of the population, that this is just somehow a misconnection inside of their, you know, physiology, and this is their natural expression. And I don't know if this is true, but I know that this is given as the basis, you know, for that there's just this concrete moral structure that we have to accept. But even if this is true, you have to also ask yourself, well, what is the consequence of the legalization in the broader society? And because laws aren't necessarily only made for the narrow protection of a minority. Laws are in general for the broad protection and the betterment of society. That's why we do these things. And if you actually, you know, an example, a parallel would be like the Great Society programs, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have this concept of, well, I mean, and people will actually make this as the argument. They go, look at all of the women that we have fed and the food that has gone into these homes, which would otherwise not have. This has to be, there's some good in the program. But that just totally ignores the enormous destructive force it has been in the general population. And I think if you, now that we've actually had a chance to look at the legalization of homosexuality, we can actually have a discussion relating to the facts, right, of what the law has produced, you can make a very strong argument that, you know, we need to recriminalize it. Because
inevitably, if it's not criminalized, it's promoted. And that's the thing.
What's happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Because those who are scheming or who organized to decriminalize were then organized to have those institutions promote it, which we've seen. So if it's not theoretical, we've seen it in the past 30, 40, 50 years. Country. So I if you doubt what I'm saying, just look at the past 40, 50 years in this country. That's the trajectory it's followed. And, you know, it's because it's not as if you criminalize it, that they're going to be busting down doors trying to find people in the act. What it does, it restricts the public behavior and also the public promotion of it, which is benefits the community. It also protects the morals. It protects the sensibilities of people, not only of adults, but also the innocence of children, which is under assault. And that is criminal. And that is an offense which may warrant something like as harsh as a death penalty when you do something like that. I think Jesus Christ himself said that for those who harm little children, it's better that they've never been born. You know, that was Jesus who said that. So, I mean, that's pretty harsh. It prevents the promotion. I mean, that's what we've seen. It's the same thing you had with laws against contraception. Wasn't as if adults couldn't obtain contraception. What it is, the laws against it prevented the government from promoting it. The moment the laws were overturned under the guise of, you know, freedom, privacy for couples, the government started promoting it. Well, that obviously wasn't a privacy issue then. That was the excuse. And it's the same thing with homosexuality, whereas it wasn't if the moral police were going down and putting cameras in everyone's room and seeing what they were doing. It kept it on the down low, if you will, in the closet, and it properly sequestered. And the moment that you got rid of these restrictions, well, you see what you have. Like I said, obviously homosexuality has always been around for one reason or another, but it wasn't always normalized or promoted. And a certain group is particularly responsible for normalizing this because it is a strategy to promote sexual degeneracy to weaken society. And that you read that the authoritarian personality, errors in civilization, it's the organized Jewish community promoting this to the American Jewish Committee. And we saw that in that video, Jewish and Proud, created by the American Jewish Committee, where Jews, the lady says, have been on the right side of everything in history. They do everything right, apparently, to this young lady. And of course, one of the right things they've done is promote the acceptance of homosexuality, gay marriage, abortion, and these things, feminism, and all these destructive things. And so again, if these things aren't explicitly, if this isn't explicitly prevented or criminalized, it's actively promoted, which then does lead to death, because basically homosexuality is the subject of the culture of death. It's literally degenerate.
And that's actually accurate. I had a discussion with a proponent of sort of the transgender meme. And I pointed out, I go, you know, there are no children that are being produced by this culture. Mm-hmm. And I mean, by no children, I mean zero. So this whole, structure, this culture that's being established only has one generation in it. That's it. Mm-hmm. Because it cannot produce, you know, like 0.0001% of replicant children. So this is the observable effects, right? This is something you can actually see that comes out of the culture that is promoted incrementally through first legalization of homosexuality. You get to a point where the culture that it has created is exposed as being sterile. It is obviously morally sterile, but it is also physically sterile. It doesn't have any kids, and it won't. So why would we promote this culture, you know, with all of these extraordinary, kind of changes to our culture, where you now have same-sex bathrooms in elementary schools, right? Things like this. I mean, why would we do that? Why would we go out of our way to promote something which doesn't even produce children? You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we now have seen it. We've now actually seen the results of the, the decriminalization. I think we can now make a more informed choice about what the consequences are in a broad social observation, and then make a better decision. And I will point out there's a parallel to the, San Francisco is now they are in an emergency situation, are hiring 200 policemen. Remember that this was Mayor Breed. She was one of the most egregious defund the police mayors that there is. And now, because she has seen and the public has seen what the decarceration movement creates, now she's making a better decision. I wish that we could go through the same process as a culture with all of these things, which we now observe really are destructive, which they were being pitched to the public. It was only the idea that they were going to lead to workers' paradise, a more moral world. There's nothing to be afraid of. You're talking about sexual superstition, that idea. And if we wrong ourselves, it's going to be just a more moral culture, but just a happier, better, healthier place. Well, Tim, I think haven't we seen enough now to be able to make a better decision?
Yeah. We've seen what it has yielded, what it's produced, and it's not good. The sort of the soft liberal approach and of tolerance again leads to its promotion and mandatory celebration. It's now everyone. If you speak out against it, because there's a baseball player that apologized for sending out, was it a tweet? There was something that wasn't complimentary towards homosexuality. He's forced to apologize. Well, that's a that's an, a point of view. Since when does playing baseball have to do with celebrating, you know, sodomy? But nevertheless, the Major League Baseball seems compelled to make him apologize and say something he doesn't believe in.
They're threatening to take away his livelihood. I mean, they really hammered the guy, and
he's no Ugandan martyr.
No, sadly. No. But you know, I mean, this is they have to do it because this isn't an organic.
No, it's top down. No,
the only way you can get it inserted is through intimidation and government, you know, and like power. I mean, that's it. That's the only way you can ever get the transgender meme to be widely believed in or even known about is through, you know, just absolute government power, top down, with propaganda, with control of the corporations. The only way you can do it is with fascism. The government and the corporations have to be unified, as for example with the Bud Light commercial, right? Mm-hmm. Where the government has created the structure, and then the corporation in unison with the government decides it's going to create a transgender spokesperson for Bud Light. Well, the public response to it shows this isn't an organic movement. This is a top-down movement. I was really happy that happened because it just puts the lie to the idea that, well, this is just, you know, a more free society. These are ideas we're having kind of like a new renaissance of an intellectual renaissance. It's not coming from anything other than just raw power that is being applied against the culture to transform it. And they're doing it for malevolent purposes. This is the thing. I mean, this is why it's so, you know, so resisted so much, is that they're obviously doing it to create a weaker and less family friendly society that's going to be a lot easier for them to control.
Yeah, which produces again more traumatized kids who are abused and therefore sexually confused and be easily groomed and manipulated, and therefore you get more people identifying as non-binary, if you will, or being homosexual because they're abused. And they're subject to trauma, and that's, you know, that's how they proliferate, or that's how they breed, if you will, recreate themselves, is through grooming and abuse. And you could argue that the whole, again, everything we're seeing with Pride Month itself is a form of grooming abuse, subjecting children to that, you know, everyone to it. Like I said, you say it's, you know, the privacy of the bedroom. Only problem is you do what you do in the privacy of your bedroom, but then the problem is you don't stay in the bedroom. You know, you go out. And so now it's if you can be a, lecherous homosexual, you know, in the evening and be a teacher during the day, and that's not going to make any difference. That's ridiculous. If you believe that, then fine. You're living with your head up your ass. If you think that's the case, you can't be degenerate in your private life and be reliable in your public life, your professional life. And that's why character matters. That's why when you have like oaths of office, ultimately it depends on your sincerity as a person and the trust. And you can't be degenerate and a lech and these things. And also being willing to prey on people and also willing to treat people like objects. You objectify people if that's your attitude. This is why traditionally the sexual morality matters so much, because ultimately it involves how you view other people. And if you view them as objects, instruments, or vessels for your pleasure and entertainment, you're a bad person and you can't be trusted.
You know? Right. I mean, in other words, there's just a very clear line. If sex is a recreation for you and that's its only function, right? Mm-hmm. Then you're not going to be, understanding and promoting the normal and healthy biology of a, you know, a heterosexual couple, which is exactly the situation we found ourselves.
Well, when you raise gay couples or homosexual lifestyle, raise it to be on par, even superior to heterosexual, you know, procreative couples, and what are you doing? You're prioritizing yourself in the very thing that leads to your society's demise.
Exactly. And so death. Exactly. And this was hidden from us. Well, I mean, to me, the particularly the transgender social movement was so obviously artificial. You know, it comes not from the public. It just comes from the government and the fascist connection into the corporations, and it's promoted. Well, you know, we've gone through the organizations, right, that are typically in back of it. So it's done to basically to destroy Europeans is what I would say is the, you know, it, as it functions socially in the United States, that would be how I would characterize it. You know, we can now look at the claim that this is going to be a workers' paradise. And we can just tell them to, hey, forget it. It's just, in fact, it's just the opposite. This is going to lead to a very weakened society, weaker than it currently is in terms of being able to resist any kind of social control, you know. And it's really very much like if the oligarchs like to, you know, give us their plans because this amuses them. I mean, Brave New World has this all recorded. And we can just look at it and see if this is where we're going.
Didn't he say that in Brave New World, or he made this observation, Huxley, is that as sexual freedom increases, political oppression increases as well?
Of course. And there's the two go hand in hand. He pointed out, in fact, this just, of course, this is, I would say, almost ironic, because if you look at MKUltra, you can read the instructions that Huxley gave to Jolly West, you know, the infamous MK Ultra doctor, about the kind of experiments that Huxley was directing him to do.
He was one of many Eskimos working for MK Ultra, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And so now you can see that when Huxley talks about, gee, you know, the government, you know, we it's going to do this or that, and then we have to protect ourselves, he's just laughing at us. Right. He's just laughing at us. This is what he is actually creating for us. And he's so confident that we're too stupid to understand this, that he can just tell it to us right in our face. This is what, you know, this is where you're going to end up.
Well, here's this thing. Did you see that thing? It was, I think, Glamour London. It featured a pregnant man on the cover.
Yeah.
And of course, the pregnant man is a trans man. But it proves that men can get pregnant, because the young lady, the deluded young lady on the front page of the magazine for June, says she identifies as a man and she's pregnant. So it proves that men can get pregnant, which is almost like saying, I identify as a dog. So when I go out and operate my motor vehicle, it proves that dogs can operate motor vehicles because I identify as a dog. Now, I made this point. I was talking to my son about that. I said, now that's nonsense, of course, and we're laughing at it. But what they're doing is they're destroying they're destroying logic and objective truth. And there's a reason for that. They want to be able to say 2 + 2 = 5, because if they have to say 2 + 2 = 4, they are bound by logic. They're bound by truth. So they want to destroy the idea of truth, destroy the idea of logic, because if you do that, then they're all powerful, and they're not going to create a situation where we're all kings, and we can all have our own truth. No, it's only those few with power, media and finance, who can impose their versions of the truth on all of us. See, when there's objective truth, there's objective reality, I can look eye to eye with a Bill Gates or a Rothschild and say 2 + 2 = 4, and there's nothing you can do about that. And if you do something, you can't do that, it's wrong. It's morally wrong. It's objectively wrong. There's objective truth. Now, how much money you have, you can't change that. And you are subject to the truth. You're subject to the law, the natural law. They want to destroy that because they want to impose their own tyranny. They want a situation where truth becomes the opinion of the powerful. And that's what, you know, that's the world. So all this nonsense we're going through, all this humiliation rituals is a part of that objective. That's what they're doing. And they want to be in a position where we can't, you know, you and I can't look at these people and go, wait a second, look at the facts. Employ logic, employ the language to challenge their power. That's the world they want to create. That's the world they're trying to create now.
And that's exactly right. Well said. I couldn't agree more. I express it as, you know, we really need to just insist on the Socratic method, that we don't believe anything because people tell us that this is true, or because we're afraid to go through the Socratic method to do so might, expose us to charges of racism or anti-Semitism or Holocaust denial, or any kind of intimidating verbal structure. You know, we just cannot ever let ourselves, be put in the position where, because we're afraid, because of intimidation, we will not insist upon what is defined as the Socratic method, which is just, it's got to be facts and reasoning to justify the conclusion. And so when you get to the idea of, well, a woman, or, a man can have a child, well, okay, this needs to be contested, because it's kind of like a double bind, which can end up with people basically being insane. So you have to, stand up for your sanity and say, no, this is not a male, or excuse me, this is not a female. This is a male. Now, this male may have an asterisk attached to him, because this would be his deluded condition, or his claim, his assertion that he's in fact a woman. But this isn't a normal woman. This is not a real woman in the biological sense. And so you just have to work through it and always insist upon it. And they, of course, will always say, well, you're not, you've created an act of violence against this person, because, the person is so pained. There's so much emotional damage that you've caused by that assertion. And you just have to say, sorry, life is tough. Tell him to just get over it as best he can, because the Socratic method trumps everything. We have to always insist on just, no matter what they tell us or what they try to intimidate us into doing, we want to make them go through the process of explaining every time, that why do you claim that this is a woman? What is the assertion? What is it based upon? It's based upon the fact that this individual states that he is a woman. Well, doesn't that exclude him from the normal category of womanhood, that has these other attributes? So it's just, their ability is basically, their power comes through intimidation. Okay, that's mm-hmm. that simple. And the solution is always just to insist upon them explaining. Please explain your facts and reasoning for the assertion.
Your logic becomes hate speech, which becomes de facto illegal. Which leads us to our next topic, perhaps. The White House this week released a national strategy to combat or counter anti-Semitism. That's apparently it's the, I thought maybe it's related, but I thought it was white supremacy or white extremist terrorism, which is the number one threat. Apparently anti-Semitism threatens to engulf the country. They rolled out, the White House rolled out its national strategy on Thursday for combating anti-Semitism. This is how it was reported, AP, as the country grapples with record levels of violence, vandalism, and hate speech directed at Jewish communities. Okay, citation needed. Did you get that from the ADL, the SPLC, right? President Biden, along with Doug Emhoff, he's the poor gentleman, has the misfortune of being married to Kamala Harris. He's called the second gentleman. Held a virtual event at the White House. It's the first time the federal government has formulated a national effort to fight anti-Semitism, and the administration's efforts contain more than 100 provisions that call for congressional action, increased monitoring by technology platforms, and improved education at the civic level. So basically, suppression of free speech, deplatforming, financial, measures, more propaganda. Biden said the strategy has four overarching themes: increasing awareness. Are you aware of anti-Semitism? And understanding an understanding of anti-Semitism. That's good, because I guess to have an understanding of anti-Semitism, you first have to define it, I suppose. Improving safety and security in Jewish communities. If I understand, Jewish community organizations get 90% of Department of Homeland Security grants for security. So if that means something's going on there, 90%, it's a little, ethnic nepotism going on there. Reversing the normalization of anti-Semitism. Okay, how do you do that? And building solidarity across communities. It sends a clear and forceful message in America: evil will not win. Hate will not prevail. The venom of anti-Semitism will not be the story of our time, Biden said in a pre-recorded message on Thursday. The strategy contains 10 separate calls for technology companies to establish a zero tolerance policy for hate speech. So there goes free speech, right? This is called hate speech on their platforms, and ensure their algorithms don't spread anti-Semitic language, says Liz Sherwood Randall, the White House's Homeland Security Advisor. Susan Rice, outgoing White House domestic policy advisor, said the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. will launch a first ever Holocaust Education Research Center. Is that what they're there for? In 2024, as part of an effort to increase awareness about the event during which millions of Jews were systematically murdered during World War II. And federal agencies will incorporate material on how to address anti-Semitism in diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility training programs moving forward. Biden in December established a government task force to coordinate efforts to fight anti-Semitism and other forms of religious bigotry. Is that anti-Catholicism? Does that count like when the LA Dodgers host the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence to insult Catholics? No. The group's first task was to create national strategy to counter anti-Semitism. So the FBI is going to target traditional Latin mass Catholics, harass pro-life activists, whatever. So what do you think with this agenda? Is it timely? Do we need it? Does anti-Semitism a threat to the nation?
It's just a lump of sophistry. I read it. You sent me the link. I was quite amazed at it because it's just so weakly reasoned. I just wanted to go through some of the language and if it's okay, just leave a few numbers so people can get a sense of this. First of all, they say the United States has recently experienced an alarming increase in anti-Semitic incidents. They use the word incidents. Mm-hmm. Now, these are not convictions. If someone reports, that there was someone who was a Jewish person or a Sikh reports an event that they regard as insulting to them, you can get this as a statistic in their category of hate crimes just because there was a reported incident. So this is the first kind of, maybe not. It seems like kind of a weak way of characterizing the events.
You've heard of the "What You're Doing, Rabbi" meme?
Yeah, well, that's right, because it's really in the eye of a holder. Now, the thing is that, but here's where.
What am I saying? If grant money is based on how many incidents are reported, conflict of interest?
Yeah, but anyway,
let's say.
So let me just show you what they do. They go. Although American Jews account for 2.4% of the U.S. population, but they are victims of 63% of reported religiously motivated hate crimes. Now, so what they've done is they've created a category side of hate crimes that is religiously motivated. And Christians just don't get this category checked as a box. They just cannot, So the idea of it, 63% of religiously motivated hate crimes, already you kind of wonder, well, what are the actual numbers? Mm-hmm. What are they actually talking about? I mean, religiously motivated hate crimes, how many of them are there? So now you get into the actual, if you dig in, you can actually, with a little bit of research, you can come up with actually what these numbers are so you can really see what they're talking about. The ADL, of all places, is where you can get the best synopsis of the federal government's production of the hate crime statistics. And anyway, they have there, this is all from the ADL, they say, in 2019, they had 1,127 incidents of harassment where one or more Jewish people reported feeling harassed. Okay. They had 919 incidents of vandalism. Now, this is almost always swastikas. Okay. Then they actually have what they claim are, altogether there was 2,107 anti-Semitic incidents. These aren't, convictions, but these are incidents that have been reported. And then they say this is a 12% increase from the 1,900 incidents reported in 2018. So you can see that they're making the case that this is growing, there's momentum, and we have to deal with it because it's becoming such a threat to our culture. Now, in terms of violence, there was 61 incidents of anti-Semitic assault. And, you know, again, without convictions and paperwork, you don't really know what exactly what goes on here. But there were five deaths which were regarded as hate crimes. Five deaths. Now you've got almost 4.5 million Jews, so you're looking at basically 1 in a million people who were killed, you know, as a result of hate crime. Just to give you like some context of that, in Chicago, there were about just under 30 whites killed by blacks in the same year. Mm-hmm. And there's just over 1 million whites. So you're talking over 20 times more sort of, you know, European individuals killed by blacks than the 1 in a million incidents of anti-Semitic assault that led to death. So it's, so you have 20, more than 20 times the murders of whites by blacks just in the city of Chicago.
So there's no White House national strategy to combat black violence.
Right. But here's here's where it goes off. They really do some clever things with the language. They talk about anti-Semitic incidents are being reported at record levels. They don't have 2020 or 2020 yet, but they have 2020. Remember, I just gave you this 2019.
I'm sorry, what's the source for this?
This is the ADL who are using, they have what's
of course, called that's a fair and objective source.
Well, but you see, the thing is, it's actually, I use it because they produce preposterous and just contradictory to their claims results. So you don't need, but because it's ADL, I'm just perfectly happy to use it. They have what's called the audit of anti-Semitic incidents, which is just basically they categorize all of the hate crimes that the Department of Justice records. Anyway, so this is where the numbers are coming from, and I'm actually reading their text. And so they track all the anti-Semitic harassment, vandalism, and assaults. And in 2020, the ADL tabulated 2,024 reported anti-Semitic incidences. Now, bear in mind that this is in a category. What I'm reading from is anti-Semitic incidents are being reported at record levels, right? This is the justification for Biden's, his introduction of this extraordinary kind of national campaign against anti-Semitism, record levels. Okay, so let's look at these numbers. In 2020, the ADL tabulated 2,024 reported anti-Semitic incidents. Now, this was a 4% decrease from the 2,107 incidents reported in 2019. It was still the third highest year on record. Okay, but it was a decrease. Now, there was, of the 2,024 incidents recorded in 2020, 1,242 were harassment. Again, these are incidents, okay. There was 750 incidents of vandalism, as people, you know, drawing swastikas. Now, this is an 18% decrease from 2019. Okay. Now there was 31 incidents of anti-Semitic assault, which is a 49% decrease from the 61 that occurred in 2019. And here's the statistic that I really kind of like sort of rolled my eyes and sort of chuckling. Now, so they had 41 victims of these were incidents, not convictions. They had 41 victims of these assaults. Okay. But guess how many fatalities that produced? I mean, I won't keep you in suspense. Zero. So there was no fatalities. Gosh darn it. So this is the ADL's records of the burgeoning anti-Semitic phenomena of that we have to, you know, like transmogrify our whole government to like deal with. Think about all of the white people that were killed by black people. And incidentally, think of like the Latinos that were, you know, killed by whites. I mean, there is no category you can come up with. You know, I'm just using blacks and whites because it's famous, it's easy to get, and because it does produce dramatic numbers, you know, that you, for context, you can understand how preposterous their claim is. When you have none, zero, right, in 2020, how can you actually with a straight face then And these are the last recorded. There are. They haven't got around to the more recent data, as far as I can tell. It's not anywhere on the internet anything that I could find. So there you are. You have no deaths. You have 41 reported assaults. I don't know where there were convictions. But again, you don't know, like, you know, if there's no deaths, these assaults couldn't have been particularly violent, because with 41 of them, you would have had at least one or two people would have died, right? If they were, you know, baseball bat to the head or something. So they were probably just pushing matches in a school parking lot or something, you know?
Well, just because, you know, another thing is just because a Jew is involved in an incident doesn't necessarily mean that the motivation is anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm. It's all self-defined.
Yeah.
If it is reported as such, the person who is recording it makes a judgment, but there is no, I mean, it's really arbitrary. And I'm sure if someone who is Jewish and who claims to have been assaulted and said the person hurled a racial insult at me, it goes right into this category. But you see, the problem with this, even with the claim of 41 victims, is there was no deaths. You can't have 41 really violent assaults with not a single one of them producing at least one fatality, right? These have to be pushing matches. They cannot be baseball bat, because with 41 of them, you'd have one at least that led to a fatality. So even the claim of the 41 victims of violence is, you know, you have to put, you know, kind of a question mark. You need a little do more research to figure out what in the heck that was. But anyway, there is no category that you can cross-reference that I can think of in all of American statistics where you'd end up with zero fatalities. I mean, if you look at transgender on transgender violence, I mean, it's got to produce one, you know what I mean? It's zero is such a profound number that it just shows that there really isn't any anti-Semitic force in our culture, which is needing to be controlled. They're doing this obviously for another reason, which is clear. They're just trying to intimidate us so we cannot bring any kind of Socratic criticism against the government, because the Jews have an undemocratic power and they are using it for their self-interest and not for the general interests of the population of the United States.
It was like that Israeli minister said so many years ago in an interview that they use anti-Semitism just to ward off any criticism. It's a weapon they pull out to pretty much immunize themselves from normal criticism, especially a group that enjoys so much disproportionate power and influence in our society. And again, and the more immunity and protection they get from accountability, the more dominance they get. And they just pile on, add on. That's what we're seeing now. The U.S. National Strategy to Combat Anti-Semitism, again, it was created in part by Doug Emhoff and several other Jews. Like I said, you'd think that they'd bring in other people to discuss this, maybe non-Jews, have a dialogue about these things. What exactly you mean by anti-Semitism? Is there legitimate criticism of Jewish power, Jewish organizations in our country? Is there such thing as legitimate criticism? Is it all anti-Semitic? Is it all, you know, pathologizing and criminalize it? Basically, the goal of this project is to, what we're seeing is a consolidation of governmental power to engage in a overt political campaign to quell in America a rising awareness of the radically disproportionate influence that Jewish people enjoy in our country, and that's to the detriment. Like I said, just like the American Jewish Committee video, Jewish and Proud. They claim that they're behind all these things like gay rights, abortion, feminism, same-sex marriage, these, you know, LGBTQ plus, transgenderism, these things. These are all based on, you know, whether or not you agree with it. If you're against it, these are very destructive, disruptive movements in our society. And they definitely deserve criticism, if not pushback. And if Jews are claiming collective credit for promoting these things, they definitely deserve to have a collective responsibility or criticism for them. That just goes with that. With this initiative, Washington, yeah, they appear to be like pushing things like the Department of Homeland Security with this grant funding and all that to use that power to expand policing. The DHS is being directed to produce research that equates concern with how Jews use political and financial power with an act of violence, so criticism. So again, pointing these things is an act of anti-Semitism itself. It's very troubling. This is just how they've normalized censorship now with this, despite using something like hate speech. The document shows an egregious lack of respect for like fundamental civil liberties. There is an executive direction or directive to the Department of Treasury to convene a forum on money service businesses institutions, along with others, to prevent online crowdfunding of what it labels hate groups. Now, what constitutes a hate group? This term has no basis in our law. And so it's specific. So basically what they're saying is you can just the labels ADL, a private organization, private criminal organization, if you will, can just label someone a hate group, give it to the FBI because they work with the FBI. And all of a sudden you're deplatformed, you're defined, you're deprived financial services. It's also the White House is seeking to institute new programs for indoctrination. They're working with the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum to, again, when they talk about Holocaust education, not engaged in open discussion, open debate about some of the problems associated with the Holocaust narrative, which is ever changing. Imposing guilt on everybody, imposing this narrative on everybody. So again, if you engage in any criticism of Jewish power, which is evidently there, because look what we're seeing, you are guilty of being a Nazi and also bringing on a second Holocaust. So there you have it. This is just the fact that the White House would announce this program and marshal all the resources of the federal government to promote this is a strong indication that we are indeed living under a system of Jewish supremacy in our country. And
certainly is a coherent idea. And if you look at the basis for the claim, you know, as I showed you, it's just non-existent. So therefore, there has to be some other reason that they would want to put this into place right now. And I would assume, and I think it is easily demonstrated, it's just because they know that there's a lot of people who are wondering about this now. That's really what's going on.
Yeah, there's a great noticing going on.
It isn't really anti-Semitism at this point. What it really is just more and more people are becoming aware that, hey, wait a second, the Jews have 2.5% of the population. They seem to have 90% of the power and they're very self-centered, seemingly. You know, they're using it for their advantage, not for ours. And so people are starting to connect things like the transgender movement and the destruction of heritage America and the Jewish political power that is related to it. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to digress for a second, and there was the article is, and the concept is so preposterous, it actually did produce some amusing moments. One of them is the collection of organizations that they've assembled already that are unified in this this concept and are going to go forward and they included the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee, which that makes sense, but they also included the Southern Poverty Law Center. Sure, mm-hmm. Say that. But then others, first of all, not a single Christian organization.
No.
Which is a little strange. I mean, they have all these 30 organizations, not a single Christian organization. But they do include things like the National Basketball Players Association.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking, well, that is interesting. I mean, obviously, this would be an owner's kind of decision to take the league into this organization. But you have to wonder what the lectures are going to be like and when they would give them. I mean, would they be given at halftime? Would it be like, now, guys, we've got to hit the boards and make sure you pass to the open man and let's work on anti-Semitism? I mean, it's just, these kinds of, the collection of individuals that they're putting together is absurd and artificial. And it's because what they're trying to fight against is non-existent. I mean, you know, as I point out, when you have zero in 2020, when there are zero examples, not a single person was killed by this force, then the idea that it doesn't exist is really the more coherent concept. So anti-Semitism as a force in our nation is, you can really make the case it isn't in existence at all, just zero. These numbers, the numbers of incidents and of violence, are really just a random walk. They would occur to any single group in any nation in the world, right? That was a minority. They would have this at the very, in the most, you know, pluralistic and morally upright nation in the world, these numbers would be even probably beyond what is being recorded here. So there just isn't anything that needs to be addressed. And the fact, well,
especially if you're a group that enjoys disproportionate wealth, higher income, and disproportionate control and of cultural media,
and anything, the media space, you know. Yeah. So it just doesn't. There has to be some other purpose for this, and I'm also, you know.
Well, how about the notion that anti-Semitism, as such, or as I describe, meaning criticism of Jews or resentment of Jews, it's never a response to Jewish behavior. They're never at all. There's not one thing Jews do that may invite criticism, or contempt, or hatred, or whatever, resentment. There's no legitimate resentment, despite the fact that, again, Jews claim to under the principle of tikkun olam, to reform and change and disrupt and destroy societies, at least the cultures. They actually said they have the power, they're the right and the power to do that. And so you're going to do that. And Barbara Spector said that. Remember, she said that, you know, Jews were spearhead to change the destruction of monolithic European ethnic states, and we're going to be resented for it. Oh, okay, so you're admitting that. So there's some basis in this resentment. And there is a collective group called the Jews that are doing this. And these various, the fact that thousands of organizations can come together and coordinate this. Well, okay. Well, so there is a Latter-day Sanhedrin that exists, and they exercise inordinate power.
Just go to the American Jewish Committee's Authoritarian Personality. Go to the final chapter where they summarize what they're going to do, and read the last three pages, and you'll see that they feel justified and are going to apply all of the psychological sciences into a form of erotic propaganda, erotic propaganda, for the purpose of ending the ethnocentrism, ending anti-Semitism, ending propensities for wanting to have a strong government. They actually go out of their way to clarify for the world what they are going to do, and then look forward and backward to read that.
So if you cite that chapter publicly, does that make you an anti-Semite?
Well, of course. And one that would be proud to be called it, because remember, you go backwards to where these people come from. This is the Frankfurt School. Mm-hmm. This is Gregor Luchos. He tried to implement,
By the way, before Hitler. Before so you can't say it was a response to Hitler. 30 it was years before Hitler. Yeah.
This cultural Marxist program, which was,
this is 1919, right?
1919 in the Hungarian Soviet, yeah. And you can see it was sexual debasement, destruction of family, all of the elements, right, that have led to our current moment. They by force tried to implement them on the culture, who overthrew them. They then decided that the idea of the Marxist revolution wasn't quite accurate, and they were going to change it to the long march through the institutions, right, the cultural Marxism. So these groups then produce the Authoritarian Personality. Now go forward, Tim, and remember that Horkheimer and Adorno show up in the Macy conference, at the cybernetics conferences, which leads directly into MK Ultra. So now you can see the psychological science that's being developed, so that they can implement their dictatorial control over the minds. Because remember, when they use the term propaganda, they are claiming to have the moral authority to transform the mind of heritage American Christian Europeans into the erotic obsession that they want through their propaganda, so that none of these categories which are displeasing to them will pop up in your personality.
Well, it was successful. I think in 1900, the United States was a broadly Christian Protestant nation. And by the year 2000, the culture was broadly Jewish in its outlook.
Yeah.
They succeeded.
Because sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the counterculture, well-named, was a success. You know, you had Playboy magazine, you had, pornography, and you also had an attack on the family, right, that's going on. So all of these are part of this project. We are being led into a world where we don't have agency, and they have all of it. This is what they're trying to achieve with the propaganda that they're so proud and feel that they are morally in a position they can actually write these words, right? Saying we are going to do this. This is what we need to do. And they talk about overcoming resistance. These are the minds of human beings that they are going to program with their erotic propaganda for the purpose of social control. So this is the world we live in. And this is why, if you understand it, then, things like, like the vaccine mandates in the Ukrainian war, you can see these aren't really tangential. These are actually part and parcel of the whole process.
Yeah, there's a piece I ran across at UN's Review talking about the quiet revolution in the country that took place in the 20th century regarding Jews upending the WASP elite. He goes by the name Jürgen Freud, I think. I don't know what his outlook is, but this part was interesting. He writes, indeed, even without being anti-Jewish, one could change the political discourse of focusing attention on what may be the biggest stealth revolution since the end of World War II. The end of the Cold War and the rise of China paralleling significance to the Jews, replacing WASPs as a ruling elite of the United States. This stealth revolution was so big and so profoundly consequential on the global scale, but there has hardly been a book written on it. The ethno-power revolution took place in what soon became the lone superpower with the demise of the Soviet behemoth. It was the death knell of old America and the Frankenstein conception of a new one. It meant a wholesale reordering of culture, foreign policy, and values. One cannot understand the logic of systemic racism, global homo celebration, wars in the Middle East, the anti-Russian hysteria, without addressing the Jewish factor predicated on it's good for Zion. Jews vilify white racism, white privilege, to prevent non-whites and idiot whites from noticing that it's the Jews who hold supremacist power in the United States. Jews are nervous about people discussing the ethno-elite revolution of Jews replacing Anglo-Americans as top dogs. Even when Joe Biden fulsomely praised the Jewish domination of media entertainment for spreading global homo and gay marriage, Jews were hush-hush about it. It suggests that even positive and flattering commentary on Jewish takeover of the U.S. is threatening the Jewish power. At the very least, it can spread consciousness that Jews do control America, thereby the West. That way, people may be more privy to as to why certain trends are favored, certain events are nudged to happen, and certain views are suppressed. This is the Jewish hand behind it, whether good or bad. Even in praise, the recognition of Jewish dominance eventually means more scrutiny and criticism, and democracy means the people speaking truth to power. The Jewish takeover of power in the United States in praise or condemnation needs to be a major subject of history, discussion, polemics, and criticism. At the very least, people will know who are the real bosses in the United States. Why isn't the story of the Jewish American takeover of America as big as the Bolshevik Revolution, National Socialist seizure of power, Mao's revolution, then Deng's counter-revolution, and the fall of the Soviet Union? Arguably, it's the biggest story because of the stature of the U.S. as a lone superpower. Furthermore, it wasn't as if the Anglos. Okay, well, that's pretty much. I thought that was a good. I guess.
Very brave and logical. I mean, and the thing is, he's exactly right.
Yeah.
This is what we need to be talking about, and you know, you have to like I've done quite a few podcasts recently where I kind of tried to define this carefully. You know, this position is not anti-Semitic. It isn't a general, you know, like claim against, you know, hatred of Jewish people. These are the Jewish oligarchs. Mm-hmm. These are the Jewish financiers, the rabbinical class. I mean, I think it's probably less than 5% of all of the Jews. And who knows what this group actually thinks of themselves, either ethnically or religion, because they're a secret society.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot penetrate into high-level Freemasonry. You can't penetrate into the Skull and Bones or Bohemian Grove or the Club of Rome or the World Economic Forum is surrounded by, you know, like two divisions of soldiers with automatic weapons. So we can't see in, you know. We can, what we are able to do is we can see the fact that the oligarchs have a unification principle, right, inside them, seemingly of Jewishness, and then they use that as a way to defend themselves against any kind of scrutiny, right?
Yeah, the overwrought language, the solipsism, the victimization, and all they see themselves as victims. This is an attempt again to just suppress anything approaching reasonable scrutiny of their power.
And then you get some guy who's like, because I'm a Jew and I really hate you for saying this because I know that I don't behave this way. Look, partner, we're not talking about you. We are not talking about the Jew in the street. It's sort of like saying, you know, we hate all Italians because of the mafia. You know, mm-hmm. We're talking about a very specific group which uses secrecy in order to get its power, implemented, and it protects itself with the Holocaust narrative, with anti-Semitism, with the hate crime concept. I mean, this is how they protect themselves from, and it's just like with Freemasonry, where people will say, well, why are you so upset about Freemasonry? I know many Freemasons. Sure you do. You know Uncle Bubba and Uncle Ted, but they are not the ones who have any kind of political power, you see. It is the combination of secrecy and political power that has to be exposed. So, it's like I really regard anti-Semitism as just one of their very best distracting kind of elements, you know, and that's why, you know, we have this proclamation from the Biden White House. It's completely fake, but what the purpose is just to keep the meme of how powerful anti-Semitism is as a cultural force in play, so no one starts working up the chain of analysis. You know, it's just like you see, like, remember with the vaccine, where you had like Kirsch and Malone and Brett Weinstein, they took control of the opposition. They were advanced. They became a kind of cul-de-sac that mm-hmm. everyone moves into. And, you know, I don't know these people personally. I can't, you know, speak to them, but I'm just saying analytically, you can create a cul-de-sac where you don't actually, you say, well, it's the Jews, right? Or it's like the military industrial complex, or it's the deep state. What good are these concepts? Mm-hmm. They don't help at all. You have to continue to go further. You have to analyze to identify very precisely the group, and then try to analyze very precisely the motivation. I mean, World Economic Forum is, in my mind, right now, the very best sort of organization to look at, to analyze, but who knows? Who knows what's above it? The problem of secrecy is really something we have to address and break through.
Yeah, because ultimately you can't have representative government when you have a situation like this.
Yep.
And especially when those elite who are not accountable are hostile.
Yeah, and they got clever. They have control of the White House, and they put out clever stuff like this.
Yeah.
Where we're now working against anti-Semitism instead of trying to use it as an analytic platform. In other words, to use the resentment against an undemocratic and self-interested control over our political system by people who claim to be Jews.
And you have government working with corporations to suppress free speech, called hate speech, or to undermine, engage in, you know, what's called tortious interference, or it's when you prevent people from engaging in commercial activity to intimidate them. And now this is obviously an open invitation for that. And, you know, obviously a government doing that, government can do that if they can bring evidence to get you and indict you for something. But this is even without the benefit of that. This is just people who have views which you don't like, and they deserve the right to shut people down just based on that. Working with corporations to do this, it's an astonishing violation, again, of the American creed. And to the extent that these Jewish organizations come out against free speech, and like I said, America, for better or for worse, it's very problematic. It's an enlightenment project or whatever, but nevertheless, Freemasonic project, whatever, we have free speech. Freedom of speech, and that's what America is. And Thomas Paine said, America, you know, we have no king, the law is king.